for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Mexican President Felipe Calderón is on an official state visit to Washington at a very sensitive time in U.S.-Mexico relations. Calderón meets with President Obama today. They're expected to talk about gun violence, drug trafficking, border tensions, and immigration. Joining me to talk about prospects for improving cooperation, here in the studio, Francisco Gonzalez of the Johns Hopkins University Graduate School, Vanda Belba Brown of the Brookings Institution, and Eric Olson of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. And joining us from the Result Video Studio in El Paso, Texas, Julian Cardona of Reuters Press. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing your phone calls, your email, your message on Facebook, and your tweets. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Let me start.
Good morning, Dan.
I'm glad to have you with us. Let me start with you, Francisco. What does President Calderón hope to achieve with this meeting?
Well, to put it bluntly, the first thing he wants is the removal of the U.S. ambassador to Mexico, with whom he's got a big problem. I'm sure during the program we'll get into that. He also wants the U.S. to move beyond the rhetoric of co-responsibility, the admission that this is a binational problem, a problem of supply and demand. So all that's been settled, but not much has happened after that. Particularly, the Mexican president is incensed at the inability of the U.S. to do anything regarding stopping or stemming the flow of illegal weapons, of assault weapons to Mexico. Much of the money proceeds from the retail sale of drugs, which also ends up in the hands of the criminals. And I think that's a really sore point, where rhetoric of co-responsibility has not led to things on the ground, meaningful things on the ground that can be shown.
Vanda Belba Brown, it sounds as though there are multiple problems, but Francisco mentioned removal of the U.S. ambassador to Mexico. Would you agree that that is at the top of Calderón's list?
Well, President Calderón was quite extraordinary in the way he personalized some of the difficulties between Mexico and the United States in a public interview, not specifically mentioning the current ambassador, Carlos Pascual, but nonetheless, many interpreted lots of the remarks as pertaining to the ambassador. And of course, for an ambassador to be effective, he needs to have a close and good relationship with the president. That said, I would urge Mexican officials to step back and see to what extent the relationship can be depersonalized. Ambassador Pascual is one of the most brilliant and competent U.S. ambassadors, a dedicated public official. And to a large extent, the concern that President Calderón has stemmed from the WikiLeaks, for which, of course, U.S. ambassadors and U.S. officials were not responsible. There is a great deal of reporting that takes place in WikiLeaks, and one should not overemphasize that. So seeing how the meetings in Washington could tone down some of the personalized aspects that have kicked in for Mexican officials would be important.
Is that possible, Eric Olson, considering those WikiLeaks, considering the president's remarks that have been made publicly?
Well, I mean, we'll see today. Depends how the conversation goes. I personally am an optimist, in part because I don't think there's much alternative. I don't think Mexico can afford to ignore the United States, and vice versa. The U.S. needs Mexico to be strong and stable, and so at some level, they need to work this out, and I'm optimistic it'll happen.
But what about the issues not being discussed at this meeting?
Well, the issues that won't probably get a lot of attention are the economic issues, the migration and migration reform issues. Again, as Francisco said, there's been rhetoric, there's been commitment from the United States to deal with them, but there's been inaction on issues of migration reform, long-haul trucking, for instance. I think they'll be raised but won't be resolved.
Julian Cardona, talk about the numbers of killings that have gone on in Mexico in just the last year.
Well, I will focus on the number of homicides in Juarez. Juarez has been, for the three consecutive years, the most violent city on earth. And we are reaching the 8,000 murder limit. We are about 7,900 or 7,900 murders until now from 2008. We have to be clear that this happened over the past 3 years. That last year we had more than 3,000 homicides, and we have a murder rate of about 239 per every 100,000 persons. It is the highest murder rate in the earth, on earth, and we have also rampant kidnap and extortion. We have more than 5,000 homicides only in Chihuahua State. That makes a region the most violent region in all Mexico. That's a snap picture of what's happening in Mexico in homicides, in Juarez.
So now, how are you able to function? How are you able to do your work considering that kind of level of violence? How are the people in Juarez able to live on a day-to-day basis?
Well, journalists can be target, but everybody can be a victim these days in the city. You are a doctor, you may be kidnapped. You run an auto parts store, you may get somebody asking you for paying an extortion fee. If you don't pay, you can be killed. It is just everybody that is in risk on this. The government has tried to describe this as a war between cartels, and the victims as related, most of them, to the drug business. But in fact, over the past 2 years, the market for crime expanded. It was at the beginning, it was just drugs. And since 2008, expanded to kidnap and then to extortion. And now everybody can be a victim. So we have lost almost 250,000 people who have fled from the city. It is 25%. Of the houses are now abandoned. They are empty. And most of the businesses operating in the city are paying extortion fee. Mm. The small stores, the small bar stores are now closing. We have 6,000 small bar stores closed over the past years. And this is much, much bigger. This is a crisis, much, much bigger than a war between cartels.
Julian Cardona, he's a reporter for Reuters in Juarez, Mexico. And Francisco Gonzalez, I would assume that President Calderon is going to speak very clearly about these killings with President Barack Obama.
Certainly. I think that one thing that the audience has to bear in mind is that this is a government that's fighting a rear guard battle. This is a government that has to step down from office in less than 2 years' time. And the Constitution does not allow re-election in Mexico. So you've got a lame dog president and his legacy, I mean, the possibility of this strategy continuing to be in place, of this partnership between the U.S. and Mexico in targeting both militarily, civilian institution building, etc. together is in jeopardy. So President Calderon is really desperate because it's quarter to the hour, and he wants something substantial from the U.S. to help prop up his fading numbers.
That, no.
Well, the issue of violence is critical. And for a long time, President Calderon and other Mexican officials maintained a line that the violence either does not really matter or even is a sign of progress. And the argument was that the narcos are killing each other, that most of the killings are between the bad guys, and so somehow that makes the violence irrelevant. That rhetoric and that line has been dropped, and we no longer hear the arguments. And we have started hearing Mexican officials some recent weeks to acknowledge that the violence needs to start coming down. But paradoxically, this the way that the Mexican government has approached attacking the drug trafficking organization, interdicting the capos, the heads at the very top of the organization, is what's to a great extent driving the violence. It's not the sole reason for violence, but it's a critical driver of violence because it destabilizes the organization, but does not destabilize them enough to prevent the organization from putting a new chief, but meanwhile it's generating a lot of turf wars over smuggling routes, over territories, and over corruption networks, which are also in great flux in Mexico.
Vanderbilt Bob Brown at the Brookings Institution. She is the author of the book titled Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency and the War on Drugs. We'll take a short break. We'll talk further when we come back and welcome your calls and comments. President Felipe Calderon is meeting with President Barack Obama today. President Calderon is also meeting with House Speaker John Boehner. What are they going to discuss, Vanderbilt Bob Brown?
Well, the key issue will be guns. President Calderon would very much like to come back to Mexico with seeing the U.S. move more forcefully on controlling guns.
And just before the break, we were talking also about the levels of violence. And you made a fascinating comparison, Eric Olson, between what's happening in Mexico and what's happened in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, there's a shocking statistic, which is the numbers of murders in Ciudad Juarez, a city of about 1.5 million, is actually greater than the number of murders in Afghanistan last year. We have to hasten and say that about two-thirds of the murders in Mexico are concentrated in about four states. So we shouldn't make the mistake that, say, Ciudad Juarez is all of Mexico, but there's an intensity of that violence that's pretty dramatic.
Julian Cardona, what about the ways in which these murders are being carried out? Can you talk about that?
We have seen extreme violence on the streets of Juarez. Decapitated men, dismembered persons, people are burned down after being shot in their cars. Houses have been burned, many houses. Any kind of violence you can imagine in your worst dreams happens in Juarez every day. We have a murder rate. Last year, we have 8.5 homicides per day on average.
That's quite a record. Eric Olson, tell us about the killings of the federal agents recently.
Well, it was an incredibly tragic event. Those agents were in Mexico to try to assist in training and part of the U.S. assistance program to Mexico. They were meeting in a central state of San Luis Potosí to do some of the training and work together with their Mexican counterparts. And they were run off the road and gunned down, apparently, by people connected to the Zetas cartel. We don't know yet. They've been captured, paraded before the press. We don't know what the judicial process will bring out. And that's actually one of the key issues.
Francisco.
I think that one of the things that President Calderon will try to remind the U.S. government when he comes is that, for example, the gun that was used to kill agent Jaime Zapata came from a Texas gun shop. And so it's very frustrating for Mexicans, for example, to see the recent failure of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, this attempt by the federal government to empower them to be able to report on multiple sales of assault weapons. This obviously was turned down by the U.S. Congress.
Then,
The guns issue is a very complicated one. There is no doubt that loose U.S. laws make interdiction very difficult, and that tighter laws would facilitate the tools that law enforcement agencies have for gun control. The Obama administration has increased gun control compared to previous administrations, but nonetheless, the loose gun laws make interdiction difficult. That said, controlling anything on the border is just extraordinarily difficult. And it's as hard to control drug flows as it is to control gun flows or vice versa. Moreover, the global gun markets in small arms is fully integrated. So even if the U.S. by some miracle was able to substantially reduce the gun flows, the cartels would simply acquire the weapons elsewhere, which is not to say that there is nothing in gun laws. One of the interesting findings of effects on violence after gun law changes and collection of weapons is that street crime often goes down, that the propensity of domestic violence or street disputes to escalate into violence goes down. But there is equal evidence, or rather that there is lack of evidence that strategic violence between drug trafficking organizations and between them and the state gets affected as a result of weapons availability.
And how effective, Julian Cardona, is the state in trying to interdict not only the drugs but also an attempt to protect its own people?
In places like Juarez, you can pretty well argue that it's a kind of failed state because security cannot be provided to citizens. The state is not owning anymore the privilege of the use of force. And you can also think of extortions as like a tax from criminal groups, and not only criminal groups, because in many cases, citizens have denounced that the federal forces are behind the extortion rings or the kidnap rings. And talking about weapons, it is impossible for a state like Mexico, with this level of corruption, to stop the flow of illegal weapons on getting into the country. We have 2,000 miles shared with the U.S. As a border, but we have also two oceans, and we have Central America. It is impossible to cut the flow. And also, the Mexican government has been blaming external factors about violence, and is not accepting its own faults on this issue. We have now people being killed beheaded, decapitated. So who is bringing us the machetes? That thing that we have to think about justice before. Like we have a 97% of impunity. And it doesn't matter if there's an automatic weapon or a pistol or a machete. What you need as a society is to have the chance to get the killers in front of a judge and to send them to jail. But it's not happening in the city, and the Mexican state is not able to provide security and justice to its citizens, specifically in a place in what is we are talking about 97% of impunity.
Well, what Julian was saying is something very important. One key role for law enforcement is to apprehend and successfully enable prosecution of criminals. But a similar key role for law enforcement, intimately linked to the first one, is to deter violent crime, to manage how criminal organizations behave. So it's very important to look at how the very same Mexican drug trafficking organizations behave in the United States and behave in Mexico. In the U.S., they control much of the street distribution. And there is a potential for warfare among these organizations as well over very lucrative drug distribution networks. Yet we don't see the violence, despite the fact that they have the weapons even more easily available in the U.S. than they have in Mexico. And the key, of course, is that they understand that the might of law enforcement would come down on them in a way that would make it very difficult for them to operate. And just one thing that's important in relations to the hit on the ICE agents, I think it was quite extraordinary that the traffickers hit them after they knew that they were hitting U.S. Officials, people with U.S. Diplomatic plates who even identify themselves as such. That just shows how they don't fear the lack of law enforcement.
Totally with impunity.
But the U.S. response was advancing an interdiction operation in the U.S. that resulted in the arrest of about 450 members of Mexican members of Mexican drug cartels in the U.S. to send a very strong signal that you cannot hit a cop, that you cannot hit a law enforcement official without paying very serious price. And the reform of Mexican institutions, law enforcement, needs to get to that point where they are so feared. And where they are seen as not being corrupt.
Eric.
Yeah, I think I was just going to make a similar point to Vonda that, there's no magic solution. We're not, Mexico's not going to solve this problem of violence quickly and overnight and totally. But how the state reacts to that violence is incredibly important. We have one U.S. agent murdered in Mexico, and you have Secretary Napolitano, Attorney General Holder, President Obama speaking out, forcefully about one agent. In Mexico, agents and police are killed regularly, and there's no response from the government. And sometimes they even say, well, he was killed because he was connected to another cartel. So there's a sense in which agents are not operating with the clear support of their own government. There's corruption, there's penetration of those agencies, and it's a very confusing situation.
And Francisco, the other huge issue on the agenda, immigration. Are President Calderon and President Obama likely to be able to find some meeting ground on that issue?
I think they will both acknowledge the need for comprehensive immigration reform. President Obama has been a sustained supporter of this approach. But the political, the electoral cycles in both countries are against any high risk, high polarizing issue coming to the table. So it's not going to happen in the U.S. in the run-up to 2012 elections with Republicans in charge of the lower house. It's not going to happen in Mexico. It might be used by parties to try to prop up the anti-American feeling, to try to prop up the nationalist feeling, saying, well, so much for co-responsibility. People continue to be abused when all they want to do is to go out and there and get work out there. So a very thorny issue, which in the U.S. is, you know, no one's going to play ball with it. In Mexico, don't be surprised if between now and the presidential elections of 2012, particularly the opposition, the left PRD and the center PRI, start ramping up the rhetoric, the nationalist rhetoric. Immigration has always been one of their favorite themes.
So considering the kinds of problems we've talked about, Phil Brown, what is the best possibility for any kind of cooperation during this visit?
Well, surprisingly, I think that the best chances for cooperation are actually not about issues that are likely to be on the agenda. Issues such as climate change control and clean energy. President Calderon embraced the topic somewhat reluctantly, but nonetheless, Cancun last year was one of the key positive moments for him, where he got a lot of very positive press and was able to show himself in a very positive statements role, unlike with respect to the drug war, which of course is going with great difficulties and violence. And he was domestically challenged on a whole lot of reforms that he wanted to do but was not able to get through the Mexican Congress. And the U.S. President has been very committed to dealing with climate change also, like on immigration, like on guns, like on integration. He faces very difficult Congress, but it's one area where there is possibility for cooperation.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Do you want to add to that, Eric?
Well, I agree entirely with what Vonda has said, but I guess the other point here is that this relationship has matured in a way over the last 4 years. It used to be, you know, U.S. looking down their noses at Mexico around drug issues and violence and saying, why don't you clean up your act? And Mexicans often look north and say, well, if we're going to clean up your act, you need to clean up your act, too. You need to deal with your weapons problem, your consumption problem. I think that kind of that framework broke down a bit in a good way in 2007, 2008, when then President Bush and President Calderon agreed on a framework of shared responsibility. It's become frayed lately, no question about it. There's some hard feelings. But I think we have to put it in a broader perspective. Both countries know they need to get along. They need to tackle these problems, all of them, jointly, or else it's going to only get worse.
All right. We have lots of callers waiting. We'll open the phones. 800-433-8850 to Daytona Beach, Florida. Good morning, Teresa.
Yes, good morning. For years, there were many reports coming out about the violent drug cartels cutting off people's heads. This has been going on a long time. It was only a matter of time before it spilled over to the United States. Reports have shown that there are hundreds of thousands of drug-related Mexican gang members spread throughout our cities. The real no-brainer is that after 9/11, President Bush failed to immediately secure our southern borders. But remember, Bush was great buddies with former President Vincenzi Fox. Also, about 7 years or so ago, the 9/11 Commission's report stated, and I quote, "Al-Qaeda is very interested in our open southern borders," unquote. So since 9/11, Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups have had plenty of time to cross our borders and form cells in the United States. But don't blame this on President Obama. If you can blame, you can blame it on the incompetence and stupidity of Bush and the Republicans.
All right. Thanks for your call. Francisco, a comment.
I largely agree with the general perspective. I think the Al-Qaeda threat is completely overblown there's no reason or no evidence whatsoever of any of these things happening.
Evidence that Al-Qaeda members are crossing the border.
Certainly not. I mean, this is first and foremost a problem whereby extended families who have dwellings both particularly northern Mexico, states like Sinaloa, Chihuahua, Durango, Sonora, Coahuila, border states with the U.S., and who also have a presence and who probably have kids who are born in the U.S. and are U.S. citizens and have big mansions in La Jolla and in San Antonio. That is the type of sociological profile that's involved in the war on drugs. It's not about insurgents. It's not about Islamists at all.
And Vanda Felbach-Brown, talk about this effort to change the birthright of individuals who have crossed the border illegally and then give birth to a child in this country. How is that affecting the thinking of individuals on the other side of the border?
Well, I'm sure that, first of all, the move is not constitutional. And part of the reason that Arizona state legislature has included that is because they are hoping to bring it to the Supreme Court and possibly see broader changes to some of the key constitutional rights and foundations of the United States. It is a very unwise move because much of the U.S. History and thriving, of course, comes from immigration. And this fundamentally challenges the very definition of what it means to be American.
Vanda Felbach-Brown, she's at the Brookings Institution. Short break, and we'll come back with more of your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Celebrating Brains Over Brawn, the story of a team of high school students in the world's premier robotics competition. What their race to build a robot could mean for innovation in American education. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back talking about the meeting that will take place today between President Felipe Calderón of Mexico, President Barack Obama, and then President Calderón is also going to meet with House Speaker John Boehner. The question of the WikiLeaks documents, Francisco, how have they informed this meeting between Barack Obama and Felipe Calderón?
Well, they certainly enraged the president of Mexico and his close circle of advisors.
Because?
This government has been fighting incessantly a PR campaign to try to convince Mexicans that its war on drug crime is paying off. And what the WikiLeaks have done is to expose that this is far from being the case. The evidence is spelled out about the systemic corruption, the competition and distrust among Mexican security agencies, and the Mexican president then hits back saying, well, the same thing happens with ICE, DEA, and CIA. Big deal. Secretary Clinton asking about how is President Calderon taking it personally. I mean, all this stress, is his decision-making style being affected? So there's both on the personal and the institution lots that has convinced Mexican public opinion that the PR campaign has been scratched, and that in fact you've got a very imperfect mechanism, a very weak institutional capacity, systematic penetration by organized cartels to try to fight this war.
Well, and another difficulty with the WikiLeaks in Mexico and with the WikiLeaks everywhere is, of course, exposing national government officials coming to U.S. officials and complaining about the deficiencies in their own organizations. And this, indeed, compromisation of sources, that's one of the most problematic things in general. But if you actually look at the Mexican WikiLeaks, I think it's extraordinarily how perceptive the diplomats, the U.S. diplomats who wrote them were. It's truly extraordinarily accurate analysis, which is very much consistent with what has been done by analysts in think tanks and universities. It was nothing radically different, yet it was the fact that it came over the signature of U.S. diplomats that enraged President Calderon. But what is also sad is that some of the U.S. diplomats, including Ambassador Pascual, have been one of the greatest proponents of focusing on institutional development in Mexico, on not over-militarizing the campaign, of enabling police training and cooperation, and also on persuading the Mexican officials to incorporate the fourth pillar into Beyond Merida, building resilient communities, focusing on how to use socioeconomic programs to strengthen communities' resilience.
Eric.
Yeah, I think what the WikiLeaks confirmed to all of us is that Ambassador Pascual and his team are really on top of it and understand the complexities of the issues, that you can't just, it's not a one-size-fit-all military approach to this, that you have to use institution building and social investments as key elements in this. Diane, I wondered if I might just talk a minute. You raised the issue of the meeting with Speaker Boehner, which I think is really not more important than the presidential, but a very important meeting. And Francisco said they will talk about guns, weapons. That's right. But I think the real issue is the money issue. As we know, there's major debates in this country about budget reductions. And there's concern, frankly, that the assistance with Mexico, the aid program with Mexico, will come under the budget acts. And in fact, some of that money was cut back by the House in their debates about this year's budget. So I think that's going to be clearly part of the discussion. Is the Republican House going to be committed to this relationship and invest in it, or are they approaching it from a different framework?
What do you expect?
Well, it's very interesting because one could say, you know, the Republicans will all be for budget cutting, but there are some very strong voices, Republican voices on the border who understand that this relationship is key. Congresswoman Granger is the chair of the House Foreign Ops Appropriations Subcommittee. She's former mayor of Fort Worth, Texas. You know, she's a strong proponent of a good relationship with Mexico, and I would suspect that within budget limits, she will look to invest more.
All right, I'm going to go back to the phones and to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Nate. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
I'm at home watching my two-year-old little boy right now color in a book and push trucks around, and it escapes me how I, my little boy, my wife who's a school teacher, are responsible for beheadings, dismemberment, shootings, burned houses, kidnapped doctors, you name it. How are we responsible? As far as last I've heard, it's not American citizens taking American-purchased firearms across the border and committing these acts. If they've identified American-purchased firearms as part of the problem. What has the Mexican government done to take that out of the equation? Have they beefed up their southern traffic on the border? It's just very frustrating, and as a law-abiding citizen, I shake my head. I don't even know what to do.
Okay.
Other than get more frustrated.
I understand your frustration. Go right ahead, Julian.
Well, President Calderon has been constantly blaming everybody for what is his responsibility, and we have been left out of this picture. One of big issue that Mexico is facing is the domestic market of drugs. If you look to Juarez is the biggest Mexican consumer of drugs city. We have the highest rate of cocaine, marijuana, and heroin consumption. And many of the homicides, beheadings, all the kind of crimes, horrific crimes you see on the streets of Juarez, what we see on the field, they are mostly related to the domestic market than for export of drugs. We haven't seen the flow of drugs being cut in El Paso of higher prices or in the U.S. And talking about weapons, it's the same thing. We are still, as a country, our politicians, our pundits are blaming the U.S. on both weapons and blaming the U.S. On consumption. But I think Mexico has to recognize the rise of its own internal market for drugs. Mm-hmm. And I think the Mexico has to recognize that there's a lot of impunity. It is impossible to solve a problem of this dimension without first accepting your own faults.
Haven't there also, Eric Olson, been charges that the ATF, the Bureau of
Alcohol,
Tobacco, and Firearms, has been selling old firearms to Mexico?
They have allowed some firearms to go through the black market into Mexico as a way to trace them, as a way to figure out how they're being trafficked. You know, this is a common law enforcement practice. But it's not their policy, clearly, to sell old weapons to Mexico at all. You're saying
it's a law enforcement
technique? Yes.
It's like a sting operation.
You have an old gun, you mark it, you see where it ends up, you've tried to figure out how it got there.
Okay. And to Dwight, Illinois. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning. What I'm calling about, the lady that mentioned about former President Bush being responsible for part of the mess we have, it's not only him, it's Congress as well. In the past 4 years, I've written over 1,000 letters regarding to congressmen as well as the two presidents regarding the open, unsafe border we have to the south. And strikingly, only one congressman responded.
Who was that?
I don't remember who it was, but it wasn't the congressman from Illinois.
Okay. What about that, Francisco?
I think that the this is definitely shared responsibility. It's people on both sides of the aisle, Republicans as well as Democrats. This democracy is a messy, lively, in many ways healthy democracy. It's very difficult to implement dramatic U-turns. My comment was more regarding the previous person who called. I wanted to say that I sympathize enormously with his perspective. I'm the father of two young boys, a wife. I am Mexican, and I have to say that I feel much safer in the streets of this country, which is not my country, the United States, than in Mexico, where I go to visit family, friends. The problem with these networks of smugglers, weapons, humans, money, is that you have to remember Mexico allowed dual citizenship since 1996, and today you've got 5 or 6 million Mexican Americans who carry both passports, and so you've got dual nationals who are carrying out the smuggling. I wish it was so easy to be able to have a black and white and say it's just the Mexicans, just the Americans. America is so much more complex. It's a melting pot, and the Mexican American community is a great example of that. So it's incorrect to say that it's Mexicans who are carrying out these activities.
Eric.
Yeah, I think this issue of the border is an extremely complex one, and one that policymakers struggle with on the other hand. On the one hand, various callers have talked about securing the border. That's a popular phrase. On the other hand, there's a real interest in the United States and in Mexico to have free and open movement of commerce. How do you secure the border without stopping commerce in a way that also affects populations on both sides of the border?
Here's a comment on Facebook from Melanie, who says, President Calderon is in bed with the cartels. Many newspapers have referenced this. He is a huge cause of this mess. Julian, do you believe that to be true?
Well, I can answer you with what we have seen on the streets. And on August 8th, 450 federal police uprose against their bosses in Juarez, in a hotel in Juarez. And they describe how the federal police operate, how the federal police is allowing drugs to move in the city, how they are framing citizens, extortioning them, demanding money, how they are breaking into their houses, everything. All was described nationwide, broadcasted on TV and radio for several hours. What they saw was nothing new for Juarez citizens. And every citizen knows the federal police does that. The only thing new was that they were saying themselves what they do on a daily basis. And many journalists, investigative journalists like Anabel Hernandez in her book, points that Genaro García Luna, one of the closest men of the president, is maybe behind these corruption rings. Mm. And he's a very powerful man. He's very close to President Calderon. Why or how is this man fully supported by him? It's something that you have to ask to Calderon.
Julian Cardona, he's a reporter for Reuters in Juarez, Mexico. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Francisco.
I think it's pretty baseless to say that the president is in bed with the cartels, but certainly some of his close collaborators appear to be. One of the problems...
But wouldn't he know if some of his close collaborators?
I want to hope that that he didn't, but that's as far as I'm willing to go. The key problem is that the same group has been in charge of security in Mexico, the civilian side of security, since the late 1980s. These were people from the PRI, and the latest, the third generation of these people is this man, Genaro García Luna. These people have enriched themselves, that their vested interests have grown enormously, but this is because they've been in charge of the anti-narcotics effort in Mexico since the late 1980s. So a great paradox is that even though Mexico became a democracy and the PRI was thrown out of power in 2009, now we've had 12 years of opposition rule, PAN rule. That side of the bureaucracy in Mexico did not change at all. The PAN inherited the same security and anti-narcotics apparatus from the PRI. I don't know why they didn't change them, but certainly these people have been in bed with the cartels for many years.
I want to take one last call from Miguel in Plano, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes. Basically, I'm in Texas. I live this every day. I hear all this. And, the WikiLeaks situation is good because it brings reality to where it needs to be, out for everybody to see what it is. In Mexico, as in many other places, and I work and live in Mexico, by the way, even though I'm not Mexican, is a way of life. Impunity is a way of life. We have to understand that Mexico is basically a failed state by all definitions.
Would you agree with that, Eric Olson?
Well, it's very clear that impunity is very high. The Human Rights National Human Rights Commission this week came out with a report that said there's impunity in 98% of the cases reported. So, yes, the justice system does not function adequately, appropriately, and until you address those problems, I think it'll be hard to stop this.
Vonda, last word.
Mexico is not a failed state, but it is clearly challenged in some of the critical domains that the state needs to provide, including public safety. That means bringing the violence down in addition to weakening the power of the cartels. It means effectively reforming law enforcement institutions that for decades have been corrupted and hollowed out.
But what can President Calderon do to effect exactly that?
I think he should use the 2 years that he has left to not let himself be trapped in a defensive crouch and instead focus on strengthening the institutional development of the justice sector, prison sector, which is still very underemphasized in Mexico, and continue with effective police reform.
Vonda Fell, Bob Brown, the Brookings Institution. Eric Colson, he's at the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. Francisco Gonzalez of the Johns Hopkins Graduate School, and Julian Cardona. He's a reporter for Reuters in Juarez, Mexico. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.